A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that probably hits a lot of parents in a place they don't talk about much. He's got an 11-month-old Ezra, and he's finding that the hardest part of parenting isn't the diapers or the sleep deprivation. It's the constant hypervigilance, the feeling that he can't take his eyes off Ezra without something going wrong. He knows some of it is responsible parenting, but he also knows some of it is anxiety talking, and the exhausting part is he can't tell where one ends and the other begins. He grew up in a broken home with an alcoholic father, so hypervigilance was basically his operating system as a kid. Now he's trying to figure out, if you can identify why you're like this, how do you actually work toward change?
This is one of those questions where the person asking it has already done half the work just by framing it this clearly. Most people never get to, I can identify why I'm like this, now what? They stop at the identification and treat it like a life sentence.
The diagnosis becomes the identity.
And Daniel's not doing that. He's saying, I see the pattern, I know where it came from, I know it's not all serving me, what do I actually do? That's a much harder question, and it's the right one.
Where do we start? Because this isn't just a parenting question. This is a nervous system question disguised as a parenting question.
It absolutely is. There's a whole body of research on what happens to children who grow up in unpredictable environments, and hypervigilance is one of the most well-documented outcomes. When you're a kid and you can't predict whether tonight is going to be calm or chaotic, your brain learns to treat everything as a potential threat. That's not a flaw. It's a survival mechanism that worked.
Then you grow up, and the environment changes, but the mechanism doesn't automatically turn off.
The brain doesn't get a memo that says, threat level downgraded, you can stand down now. It keeps running the same firmware. What Daniel's describing, the freezer, the edge of the bed, the constant scanning, that's the firmware doing exactly what it was trained to do. The problem is, the training data was a childhood of chaos, and now it's being applied to a relatively safe apartment with an 11-month-old who is, let's be honest, mostly just trying to figure out what cold feels like.
11-month-olds do have a talent for finding the one thing in a room that could hurt them.
And that's where the line gets blurry, because some vigilance is appropriate. 11-month-olds are basically tiny scientists with no sense of self-preservation. You should be watching them. The question isn't whether to be vigilant, it's how to distinguish between the vigilance that's actually protecting your kid and the vigilance that's just your nervous system running old scripts.
That distinction is hard to make in real time. When Ezra's climbing on the edge of the bed, Daniel's heart rate spikes. Is that the responsible parent recognizing a real fall risk? Or is that the hypervigilant kid from 30 years ago bracing for chaos that isn't coming?
The answer is probably both, and the work is learning to tell the difference, which is genuinely difficult because the physiological response feels identical. Your body doesn't label its adrenaline surges with this one's justified and this one's a trauma echo.
What does the work actually look like? Daniel's asking a practical question. He knows where this came from. He's on anxiety medication. He's asking, what do I do?
There's a framework I think is useful here, and it comes out of the trauma recovery literature. It's about moving from hypervigilance to what some clinicians call flexible attention. Hypervigilance is rigid. You're scanning everything, all the time, at the same intensity. Flexible attention means you can dial it up when the situation actually calls for it, and dial it down when it doesn't.
Which sounds great in theory. How do you actually train that?
One approach with evidence behind it is called grounding with reality testing. You catch yourself in a hypervigilant moment and do a quick, almost mechanical check. What am I actually looking at right now? What is the actual risk level here? What would a reasonable observer say? It's not about talking yourself out of the feeling. The feeling is going to show up regardless. It's about creating a tiny gap between the feeling and your response to it.
Instead of seeing Ezra near the freezer and immediately snapping into full alert, you pause and think. He's standing in a well-lit room. I'm 3 feet away. The freezer door isn't heavy enough to cause serious injury. The worst case here is a bumped head or cold fingers. That's not nothing, but it's not an emergency.
And the key is, you're not dismissing the concern. You're calibrating it. You're giving your brain new data. Over time, with repetition, the brain starts to update its threat model. It learns that not every situation requires the same level of alert. But it takes practice, because you're essentially retraining a system that's been running for decades.
I think there's something else here too, which is that Daniel mentioned context switching and splitting focus. That's the ADHD piece. And hypervigilance and ADHD interact in a really specific way that I don't think gets talked about enough.
Say more about that.
ADHD already makes context switching hard. Your brain doesn't smoothly transition from one task to another. It kind of lurches. And hypervigilance adds this constant interruption layer on top. Every time Ezra moves, your attention gets yanked away from whatever you were trying to focus on. So you're not just context switching between work tasks. You're context switching between work and threat assessment, dozens of times an hour. That's exhausting in a way that pure work focus or pure parenting focus isn't.
There's research on this. Studies on parenting with ADHD show that the attentional demands of supervising a young child hit differently when you already have executive function challenges. It's not that parents with ADHD are less attentive. In some cases, they're more attentive because they're overcompensating, but the cognitive cost is higher. Every attention shift depletes a little more of your executive function reserve, and by the end of the day, you're running on empty.
If you add a trauma history on top of that, where your baseline is already elevated, you're starting each day with less in the tank than someone without that history. By mid-afternoon, you're not just tired, you're neurologically depleted.
Which is why Daniel's observation that some of the work needs to come from within is so important. Environmental changes help. Baby-proofing, creating safe spaces, but they don't address the internal calibration problem. You can baby-proof an entire apartment and still find yourself scanning for threats that aren't there.
Let's talk about the environmental piece for a second, though, because Daniel mentioned they're moving to a new apartment and hoping it'll be more conducive. What actually makes an environment conducive to reducing hypervigilance?
A few things. One is sight lines. If you can see the main play area from wherever you're likely to be sitting or working, you don't have to physically get up to check on the kid, which reduces the friction of monitoring. Another is what childproofing experts call yes spaces. Areas where you've removed essentially everything dangerous, so you can let the kid explore without constant intervention. The idea is you create at least one zone where your default can be, he's fine, rather than, I need to watch him.
The yes space concept is interesting because it's not just about physical safety. It's about giving the parent permission to relax.
And for someone with a hypervigilance pattern, that permission is hard to internalize. You can look at a room that's been professionally baby-proofed and still think, but what if he finds a way? Because your brain isn't responding to the actual environment, it's responding to an internal model that says danger is always possible.
Which brings us back to the internal work. What else is there besides the grounding and reality testing?
Another approach that's gained traction is scheduled worry time. You designate a specific time, say 10 minutes in the evening, where you deliberately think through all the safety concerns you have. If a worry pops up during the day while you're watching Ezra, you note it and defer it to the scheduled time. The goal isn't to eliminate the worry, it's to contain it so it doesn't hijack your attention throughout the day.
That's clever, because it doesn't ask you to stop worrying. It just asks you to postpone it. Which is a much more achievable request for a brain that's been trained to scan for threats.
Over time, the brain starts to learn that not every worry needs immediate attention. Some things can wait. That's a new experience for someone whose childhood taught them that ignoring a potential threat could have real consequences.
I want to go back to something Daniel said about growing up with an alcoholic father. Because that's not just a general, unpredictable environment. That's a specific kind of unpredictability where the threat isn't just the environment. It's a person who's supposed to be a source of safety.
That's a crucial distinction. When the source of unpredictability is a caregiver, the child's dilemma is much more profound. You can't just avoid the threat, because the threat is also the person you depend on for survival. So the hypervigilance gets wired in at a much deeper level. It's not just, I need to watch out for danger. It's, I need to read this person's emotional state constantly to know whether I'm safe right now.
That skill, reading emotional states, scanning for subtle signs of escalation, that's exactly what gets repurposed later as a parent. Except now you're scanning an 11-month-old who isn't dangerous. He's just exploring. But the scanning mechanism doesn't know the difference.
This is where some of the therapeutic approaches for adult children of alcoholics get interesting. One of the core insights is that you have to grieve not just the childhood you had, but the parenting skills you didn't get to observe. If you grew up in a chaotic household, you didn't have a model of what calm, appropriately vigilant parenting looks like. You're inventing it from scratch, and you're doing it while fighting your own nervous system.
Which is incredibly hard. And Daniel seems to be doing it, by the way. He's taking Ezra to the doctor when needed. He's intervening to prevent injuries. The question isn't whether he's a good parent. The question is how to make the experience of parenting less exhausting for him.
And I think part of the answer is something that doesn't get said enough. You can be a good parent and still find parenting draining. Those things aren't in conflict. Especially when you're working against a nervous system that was calibrated in a war zone. Even if the war zone was a living room.
Let me ask you something. You were a pediatrician for a long time. You saw a lot of parents. Did you ever see parents who were clearly overvigilant? And did you have a way of talking to them about it?
All the time. And the approach I learned was never to say, you're worrying too much, because that just makes the parent feel judged and doesn't actually help. Instead, I try to help them build a framework for thinking about risk. With infants and toddlers, the question is usually, what's the actual likelihood of serious injury here, and what's the worst case if something does go wrong? Most of the time, the worst case is a bruise or a scare, not a trip to the emergency room.
A bruise is not a failure of parenting. It's a side effect of a kid learning to move through the world.
They bump their heads. They put weird things in their mouths. That's not a sign that you're not watching closely enough. It's a sign that they're developing normally. The goal isn't to prevent every minor injury. The goal is to prevent the serious ones and to be present enough to respond when something does happen.
I think that's a reframe that might actually help someone with hypervigilance. Instead of, I need to prevent everything, which is impossible and exhausting, it's, I need to be present enough to respond. That's a much lower bar, and it's actually achievable.
It shifts the focus from anticipation to responsiveness. Anticipation is infinite. There's always another scenario you could worry about. Responsiveness is finite. You deal with what actually happens.
There's another layer here that Daniel hinted at, which is the uncertainty piece. He said he has a hard time dealing with the wavy nature of not knowing what fluctuating degree of vigilance is appropriate. That's the anxiety talking, but it's also a hard problem. Parenting a mobile infant is inherently uncertain. How do you calibrate vigilance when the target keeps moving?
Part of the answer is accepting that perfect calibration isn't possible. You're going to be too vigilant sometimes and not vigilant enough other times. That's not a personal failure. That's just the nature of supervising a small human who's actively trying to discover new ways to endanger themselves. The goal isn't to get it right every time. The goal is to get it right enough most of the time and to forgive yourself for the misses.
Forgiveness is a big word here. Because if you grew up in an environment where mistakes had serious consequences, if missing a cue meant walking into a volatile situation, then forgiving yourself for a parenting miss feels dangerous. The internal logic is, if I forgive myself, I'll get complacent, and if I get complacent, something terrible will happen.
That's the trauma logic, and it's very compelling because it feels like wisdom. It feels like you're being vigilant in a way that protects people. But the reality is that constant high alert doesn't actually make you a better parent. It just makes you a more exhausted one. And exhaustion leads to worse decision making, not better.
There's a study I came across that looked at parental fatigue and injury rates in children. The finding was that exhausted parents don't necessarily have more accidents, but they do have more near misses, and they report much higher stress levels. So the hypervigilance isn't actually preventing more harm, it's just increasing the subjective cost of parenting.
Which is a really important point. If the hypervigilance were actually making Ezra safer, you could argue it's worth the cost. But the evidence suggests it's mostly just making Daniel more stressed without a commensurate safety benefit.
If the hypervigilance isn't actually protecting the kid, what is it protecting?
That's the question, isn't it? I think it's protecting Daniel from a feeling he learned a long time ago, the feeling of being caught off guard, of something bad happening that he didn't see coming. That feeling is unbearable for someone with his history because it echoes the original trauma. So the hypervigilance is a defense against that specific feeling, not against actual danger to Ezra.
It's a loop.
Breaking that loop is the work, and I think part of it is learning to tolerate the feeling of not being in complete control. Because that's what's underneath all of this. The terror of something happening that you didn't anticipate and couldn't prevent.
For someone with an alcoholic parent, control was never really available in the first place. You couldn't control the drinking. You couldn't control the chaos. So hypervigilance was a substitute for control. If I watch closely enough, maybe I can see it coming and prepare.
Now, as a parent, the stakes feel even higher because it's not just your own safety, it's your child's. So the old coping mechanism kicks into overdrive. But the situation is fundamentally different. Ezra isn't an unpredictable, intoxicated adult. He's a predictable, developmentally normal infant. The threats are real, but manageable. The environment is safe, but not perfectly controlled. Learning to trust that difference is, I think, the central task.
Let's get practical again. What are some concrete techniques for learning to trust that difference? We mentioned grounding and scheduled worry time.
One that's been studied in the context of parenting anxiety is behavioral experiments. You deliberately test your catastrophic predictions. You let Ezra climb on the bed while you're sitting right there, and you watch what actually happens. Most of the time, nothing happens. Or he wobbles and you catch him. Or he falls onto the mattress and looks surprised for a second and then keeps going. The point is to gather real-world data that contradicts the catastrophic predictions your brain is generating.
You're essentially running experiments on your own anxiety.
And the key is, you do it in controlled conditions where the actual risk is minimal. You're not letting him play near an open window. You're letting him explore a slightly elevated surface with you right there. The anxiety says, this is dangerous. The data says, nothing bad happened, and even if something had, I was right there to intervene.
That requires a certain willingness to sit with discomfort, though. Because in the moment, your heart is pounding and every instinct is telling you to grab him.
And that's where the grounding techniques come in. You notice the pounding heart, you name it. This is my trauma response, not an actual emergency. And you stay put. You don't have to be comfortable, you just have to not act on the impulse. Over time, the impulse weakens.
I think there's also something to be said for narrating this to yourself out loud. Not in a weird way, but just, Ezra is climbing on the bed. He's done this before. I'm right here. If he falls, the mattress is soft. He might cry for 30 seconds and then be fine. Saying it out loud engages a different part of your brain than just thinking it.
There's actually evidence for that. Verbalizing a threat assessment activates the prefrontal cortex in a way that helps regulate the amygdala's fear response. It's not a magic trick, but it does help.
What about the ADHD piece specifically? Because context switching and hypervigilance together create a particular kind of cognitive load. Are there strategies that address both at once?
One approach is to externalize the monitoring as much as possible. If you can set up a physical environment where you don't have to constantly scan, a playpen, a gated area, a baby monitor with a video feed, you reduce the number of attention shifts required. Your brain doesn't have to do the work of constantly checking, because the environment is doing some of that work for you.
For someone with ADHD, externalizing cognitive tasks is generally a good strategy anyway. Don't rely on your brain to remember things. Put them in a system. Don't rely on your brain to monitor the kid. Put them in a safe zone.
The less you're asking your executive function to do, the more you have left for the things that actually require your attention.
The other thing about ADHD and hypervigilance is that they can create a kind of attentional ping-pong that's especially draining. You're trying to focus on something, and your attention gets yanked away by a movement or a sound. It gets yanked away again. Each of those transitions has a cost, and they add up fast.
There's a concept in attention research called attentional residue. When you switch tasks, part of your attention stays stuck on the previous task for a while. So even after you've looked back at your work, part of your brain is still processing what Ezra was doing. You're not fully present in either domain.
Which is exactly what Daniel described. Keeping one eye on Ezra while trying to think about something else. It feels like multitasking, but it's really just rapid switching with high attentional residue.
The solution, counterintuitively, is to stop trying to do both at once. If you're going to watch Ezra, watch Ezra. Give it your full attention for a defined period. If you're going to work, work and trust that the environment is safe enough that you don't need to scan constantly. The switching is what's exhausting, not the individual activities.
That requires a level of trust in the environment that might not come naturally to someone with a hypervigilance history.
And that trust has to be built, not demanded. You can't just tell yourself, everything's fine, stop worrying. You have to accumulate experiences where you didn't watch constantly and nothing bad happened. That's the behavioral experiment approach again.
I'm thinking about the long arc of this. Ezra is 11 months old now. In a few months, he'll be walking, then climbing things you didn't even know were climbable. The vigilance demands don't go away. They just change shape. How does someone working on this issue prepare for the next stage?
Because if you're only working on hypervigilance in the context of an immobile or semi-mobile baby, you haven't really solved the problem. You've just solved it for this particular phase. The deeper work is about the relationship to uncertainty and control, not about the specific hazards in your living room.
The toddler phase is going to test all of this in new ways.
Toddlers are basically agents of chaos. They're faster, more creative, and have even less sense of self-preservation than infants. If you haven't done the internal work, the hypervigilance just ramps up to match the new threat level. The key is to build the calibration skills now, while the risks are relatively manageable, so that when the risks increase, you have a framework for assessing them rather than just panicking.
That's a good argument for doing this work now rather than waiting. 11 months is actually a kind of sweet spot. Ezra is mobile enough to create vigilance demands, but not so mobile that you can't experiment with dialing it back.
The other thing that happens around this age is that kids start to develop some rudimentary sense of danger themselves. Not a lot, don't count on it, but they start to learn that some things hurt and they should be careful. So the parents' vigilance can start to shift from pure prevention to a mix of prevention and teaching.
That's a reframe that might actually help. Instead of, I am the sole barrier between my child and disaster, it's I am gradually teaching my child to recognize and manage risk, and in the meantime, I'm here to catch the big stuff.
That's a much more sustainable model, and it's closer to what good enough parenting actually looks like.
Let's talk about the good enough parent concept, because I think it's directly relevant here. The pediatrician Donald Winnicott coined the term good enough mother back in the 50s, and the idea was basically that kids don't need perfect parents. They need parents who are responsive enough, consistent enough, present enough. The enough is doing a lot of work.
Winnicott's insight was that parental imperfection is actually important for child development. If the parent is perfectly attuned at all times, the child never learns to tolerate frustration or develop their own coping skills. The parents' occasional failures, the moments when they're not perfectly vigilant, not perfectly responsive, those create the space for the child to start developing autonomy.
The hypervigilant parent who's trying to prevent every possible mishap is actually, in a weird way, depriving the child of opportunities to learn.
Within reason, yes. Ezra falling off a low bed onto a soft surface and being surprised. That's actually a learning experience. He's learning about edges, about gravity, about cause and effect. If you prevent every fall, he doesn't learn those things, and he doesn't develop the caution that comes from experience.
That's a hard thing to internalize if your own childhood taught you that bad things happen when no one's watching.
Because the lesson from childhood was, if I'm not vigilant, disaster strikes. The reality with Ezra is, if I'm not vigilant for 30 seconds, he might bump his head and learn something. Those are very different stakes, but the body doesn't know that.
Part of the work is literally teaching your body the difference, which is not something you can do through reasoning alone.
This is where somatic approaches come in. Things like breathing exercises, progressive muscle relaxation, even just noticing where you're holding tension in your body and deliberately releasing it. The hypervigilance lives in the body as much as in the mind. If your shoulders are up around your ears every time Ezra climbs on something, you can't think your way out of that. You have to physically relax.
There's a phrase I've heard in trauma circles, the body keeps the score. It's from Bessel van der Kolk's work. The idea is that traumatic experiences get encoded in the body, not just in explicit memories. So talk therapy alone often isn't enough. You need body-based approaches too.
Van der Kolk's work is really relevant here. He's shown that trauma survivors often have a heightened baseline of physiological arousal. Their bodies are literally primed for threat at all times. That's not something you can reason with. It's a physiological state that needs to be regulated through physiological means.
For Daniel, the anxiety medication is presumably helping with some of that physiological baseline. But medication alone won't teach the body to distinguish between a real threat and a trauma echo.
Medication can lower the overall volume, but it doesn't retrain the discrimination. That's where the behavioral experiments and the grounding and the somatic work come in.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said about the weekend. He said it's the weekend, so he's not focusing on work, but he's still in that split attention mode, keeping one eye on Ezra while trying to think about other things. And I think weekends are actually harder for this, because there's no clear boundary. During the work week, you can say, I'm working now. I'll be fully present with Ezra later. On the weekend, it's all blurred.
The lack of structure on weekends can actually make the hypervigilance worse, because there's no designated off time. You're always sort of half parenting, half doing other things, and that's the most draining mode of all.
One practical recommendation might be to create weekend structure that mimics the work week structure. Designate specific times when you're fully on parent duty, and specific times when you're off. Even if off just means you're in the same room but not actively monitoring.
The off times require someone else to be the primary parent, which might not always be available. But even if you're the only adult in the house, you can create off times by using a playpen or a fully baby-proofed room where you can let your attention go elsewhere for a while.
The key word there is, you can't half relax. You have to actually trust that the environment is safe enough for you to disengage.
Building that trust is incremental. Start with 5 minutes. Your brain needs to accumulate evidence that the world doesn't fall apart when you stop scanning.
I think there's also something here about self-compassion. Daniel grew up in an environment where he probably didn't get a lot of modeling of self-compassion. If your parent is an alcoholic, the household tends to revolve around the parent's needs and the parent's volatility. The child's needs get deprioritized. So the skill of saying, I'm doing enough, I can rest now, was never learned.
That's a profound point. Self-compassion is a skill, and like any skill, it has to be learned and practiced. If you didn't grow up with it, you have to deliberately cultivate it as an adult. And for parents with trauma histories, self-compassion often feels selfish or dangerous. Like if you're kind to yourself, you'll let your guard down and something terrible will happen.
The work is not just behavioral. It's also about rewriting a deep narrative about what it means to be a good parent and a good person.
That narrative work is slow. You don't just decide to be self-compassionate and then it happens. You have to catch yourself in the old patterns. The self-criticism, the catastrophizing, the pushing through exhaustion, and deliberately choose a different response over and over until it starts to feel natural.
Which is exhausting in its own way, at least at first, but probably less exhausting than a lifetime of hypervigilance.
That's the trade-off. The work of change is hard up front, but it pays dividends. The work of staying the same is just hard forever.
Let's get specific about one more thing. Daniel mentioned that some of the interventions he's made have been necessary. Taking Ezra to the doctor, preventing injuries, so he's not imagining the risks. How does he hold on to the ability to recognize real risks while dialing back the false alarms?
That's the calibration question in a nutshell. And I think the answer is that you don't try to eliminate the vigilance. You try to add a pause between the vigilance and the action. When you notice a potential risk, you take a breath and you ask, is this an actual emergency, or is this a situation where I can watch for another few seconds and see what happens? Most parenting situations with an 11-month-old are the second kind.
The pause is everything, because the hypervigilant response is immediate. See threat, react. The calibrated response is see potential threat, assess, then decide. That gap between stimulus and response is where the growth happens.
That gap is trainable. Every time you pause, instead of reacting immediately, you're strengthening the neural pathway for calibrated response. It's literally building new brain circuitry.
Which is hopeful, actually. The brain is plastic. The patterns that were laid down in childhood can be reshaped. It's not easy, and it's not fast, but it's possible.
And Daniel already has the hardest piece, which is the insight into where the pattern came from and the motivation to change it. That's more than most people ever get to.
If we were going to distill this into something actionable, not a prescription, but a starting point, what would we say?
I'd say start with the pause. When you feel the hypervigilance kick in, don't try to suppress it. Just notice it and take one breath before you act. That's the foundation everything else builds on.
Then add the reality check. What's the actual worst case here? What's the most likely case? Am I responding to what's in front of me or to something from 30 years ago?
The environmental piece. Create at least one space where you can relax your vigilance because you know it's safe. Give your nervous system somewhere to rest.
The self-compassion piece. You're not a bad parent for finding this hard. You're a parent with a history that makes this particular aspect of parenting harder than it is for some other people. That's not a moral failing.
Finally, I'd say, let Ezra surprise you. Let him show you that he's more capable than your anxiety gives him credit for. He's not a fragile object that will shatter if you look away for a moment. He's a resilient, developing human who is learning to navigate the world, partly through your protection, and partly through his own trial and error.
That's a nice way to frame it. The hypervigilance assumes fragility. The reality is resilience.
Both in Ezra and in Daniel.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Roman provincial road maintenance standards were still being cited in Dutch legal disputes over land access in what is now New Zealand's South Island. Not because Roman law applied there, but because 17th century Dutch surveyors had used Roman road width specifications as a convenient default in their colonial charters. And by the 720s, those charters were being litigated by Maori claimants who had never agreed to them in the first place.
Right, right. The Roman Empire's road specs ended up in a Maori land dispute in the 1700s. That's a sentence I didn't expect to hear today.
The bureaucratic afterlife of empire is unsettling.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.